that God exists and whether it's provable that God exists. And in the short time that we have this evening, I'm going to do my best to try to give you something to chew on, and I hope perhaps something that will persuade you on that matter as well. On April 7th, 1980, Time magazine had this to say. I quote it, "In a quiet revolution in thought and argument that hardly anyone could have foreseen only two decades ago, God is making a comeback in the crisp intellectual circles of academic philosophers." I suppose when Time magazine finally takes account of something, you know that it's real. You know that something's going on. You know, you don't really exist unless you're in the pages of Time magazine. Well, now God is making a comeback in the pages of Time magazine, or at least according to Time magazine, because intellectual philosophers, academic philosophers, are beginning to pay attention to this question and reconsider it. For quite a while, I think people would have said, this whole issue of the existence of God and arguments for the existence of God is really old-fashioned, is really quite dead, really very irrelevant to contemporary affairs. And we're finding that we can't live our lives by ignoring God and the question of God. And of course, if we're going to scrutinize things and be rational people, which is what we're taught to do at the university level, then we're going to have to look at this question of God and be academic about that as well. It's a crucial question, whether God exists. When we consider the question of God's existence, we are going to eventually find out one way or another what is the greatest of all illusions. You know, Sigmund Freud suggested that belief in God was the greatest of all illusions, amounting to something on the order of collective insanity. Obviously, if God does not exist, then those who believe in God are holding on to an imaginary friend, and they are somewhat like children who have not matured, who have not grown up, not been able to give up their imaginary friends. But you know, you can see it the other way around too. If God does exist, then atheists are like children as well, children who deny their own parents' existence. And either way, the child that never grows up and can't give up imaginary friends, or the child that somehow cannot believe that he or she has parents, either way, you've got someone who's bogged down in the world of fantasy, someone who's on the border of insanity. And yet you can't have it both ways. You have to either believe that God does exist or believe that he doesn't. Now, I'm here tonight because I do believe that God exists. And I believe that God's existence is an objective truth. I believe that God's existence is provable. And so I'm coming and kind of putting everything on the line for you tonight. I'd like to explain to you at least one line of reasoning that would suggest that God certainly does exist. And I hope that you'll find it engaging. Now, the question of the truth of God's existence, we have to remember, has nothing to do with questions about psychology, questions about the character of those who argue one way or another about God. The question of God's existence and the truth of God's existence has nothing to do with the psychology of atheists or the psychology of theists. It has nothing to do with the character traits of atheists or the character traits of theists. And I have to tell you that at the outset, because so much of the literature that clutters up Western history on the question of God's existence is really bogged down in what we in philosophy call the genetic fallacy. That is, the fallacy of trying to determine the truth of an idea on the basis of its subjective origin. Who is propounding this idea, and why is he or why is she propounding this idea? And then if we don't like the person, or something about the person, or if we find the motives somehow ignoble, then we reject the conclusion that they've reached. I want you to stop and think about that for a minute. If I happen to have learned algebra back in junior high school from someone that eventually was caught and convicted of being a child molester. If I learned algebra from a child molester, is the algebra that I learned invalidated by that? That is, this terrible, wicked thing about the person who taught me algebra take away from the truth of algebra? And obviously it doesn't. Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone out of some kind of insane hatred for his father, who happened to be a postman. I don't know if he was or not, but if that were to be the case, that he just hated the postal service and hated his father, and that's why he was driven to invent the telephone. And if he did so out of some kind of sordid aim of getting rich and selfish. We may not like the man. We may not think his motives are noble, but it wouldn't invalidate the truths that he discovered about telephone technology. And so the truth of God's existence has nothing to do with the character of theist or the character of atheist. It has nothing to do with their aims or motives. Commonly, we hear charges against people who believe in God's existence, charges made against theism as a system. Psychologists will tell you that theism originates really in fear and in wishful thinking. As Freud said, people are theists because they look for a substitute for their lost earthly father. And so they project this heavenly father to take the place of their lost earthly father. People say that theists have failed to grow out of their infantile dependency stage of maturation. They'll tell you that theism distracts from the pleasurable life of the here and now and engagement in this world. We'll hear that theism is the ploy of hypocritical preachers who are just trying to really get their way and to be paid for what they do. Theism has been accused of being a tool for the suppression of the manliness and independence of people, or an agent for oppressing the minorities, or oppressing the poor, or recently oppressing women. These are common charges against theism, but you need to realize that each and every one of those charges is reversible. And of course, if a theist were to argue this way against an atheist, the argument would be equally subjective, equally vague, equally fallacious. But nevertheless, the charges are reversible. Just think about it. A theist could say of all atheists that their atheism originates in fear, really, fear of judgment before God, and their atheism originates in wishful thinking about their own independence in this world. What if we were to do some research and then conclude that, as it turns out, Freud had a very bad relationship with his biological father. And that must be the reason he took his vengeance out and supplemented that anger by getting rid of a heavenly father, because he didn't dare confront his own biological earthly father. Would that have anything to do with the truth or the falsity of atheism? It wouldn't at all. We could argue that atheism actually prevents enjoying life to its fullest. Because we look at the lives of atheists and we see how they're full of angst, this foreboding dread and misery. Atheists are often confused people. We often see people engaged in a life of dissipation who are atheists. Does that mean that atheism is false? It doesn't have anything to do with the truth or the falsity of atheism. Atheism has been used as a tool for justifying statism in many places in this world throughout Western history. It's been used as a tool for pragmatic intolerance of certain social groups. It's been used as a tool of oppression against people. Just think of Marxist, Leninist communism and its history in the 20th century. Atheists are just as able to be hypocritical, oppressive, rotten people as theists are. The truth of the question about God's existence, the truth of theism or atheism, has nothing to do with the motives of those who are atheists or the motives of those who are theists. And I would remind you that for every snide reference that is made by atheists to the Inquisition, the theist can match it with a reference to the French Revolution, or more recently, to Cambodia. For every snide reference made by the atheist to Puritan strictures and the witch trials, the theist can match it with a reference to the gulags and to the Marquis de Sade. For every snide reference made to the hypocrisy of Jim Baker and Jimmy Swagger, the theist can match it with a reference to the debauchery and the arrogance and the hypocrisy of atheist intellectuals like Shelley and Byron and Marx and Hemingway and Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre. The question of the truth of God's existence has nothing to do with the psychology and nothing to do with the character of those who are arguing one way or the other. But very simply, when we consider the question of God tonight, we must all eschew what is called the genetic fallacy, or more broadly, eschew ad hominem argumentation, arguments against the man holding the position rather than against the merits of the position itself. Now, I recognize as I try to set before you a proof of God's existence tonight that the existence of God is a very, very personal question. It's a personal question in the sense that it touches all of us deeply. It concerns all of us vitally, however you come out on that, yes or no. It's a very personal matter. It certainly touches us and concerns us in the most important aspects of human experience. As you go through life, you face the enigmas of your own personal identity, the enigma of suffering and evil in this world, the enigma of love, the final enigma of death. And in those crucibles, theists and atheists both find how personal, how deep is the issue of whether God exists or not. However, the question about the existence of God is not a personal question in the sense that it depends upon your personal feelings. I'm afraid that many people dismiss what we are talking about tonight because they think that, well, it's so personal, this question of God. You really can't get down to academic or philosophical discussion of it. It's just too personal. You see, it's not personal in the sense that the existence of God depends on your personal feelings, that it's subjective in the way that, say, your preference for Bach over Bon Jovi might be subjective and personal. It's not that kind of question at all. And maybe I should say just a little bit more about the parameters of my presentation tonight. This is not a lecture that addresses people that have that personal mindset that William James called tender-minded. That is to say, there are people who are often swayed more by personal and subjective factors and what they're going to believe than they are by objective issues like evidence and proof and logic. There are people who are swayed more by the utility or the happiness or the comfort or the need satisfaction that a belief or a conclusion might bring them. There are people like that. And I have to tell you at the very outset, so that you don't leave here disappointed tonight, that my lecture is not going to appeal to those who believe in God because such faith comforts them. It may be true that a belief in God comforts you, but that has nothing to do with what we're going to be arguing tonight. For you see, if God is a delusion, if God doesn't exist, if God is just as much a delusion as, say, the tooth fairy, who in his or her right mind would be truly comforted by holding on to that kind of a myth? The heart simply cannot rest in what the mind rejects. And so when we talk about the existence of God, it won't be a question of whether the existence of God would comfort you, prove to bring utility or happiness or some kind of satisfaction or needs to you. We have to all remember the quip of Karl Marx when he said, "Religion is the opiate of the masses." If religion is no more than an opiate, then it isn't worthy of a rational man's attention. So this lecture is not going to appeal to the tender-minded who are swayed by personal and subjective factors. And for that reason, this lecture is not going to convince, and it's not even going to attempt to convince, those who refuse to believe in God because that would hamper their desires or make them unhappy. You see, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And if we can't argue about the existence of God based on how nice it would be if there is a God, we can't argue against the existence of God on the basis of the fact that that might hamper my desires or make me unhappy in some way or another. The existence of an all-knowing God was absolutely disgusting to the existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre. In his autobiography, he writes that the day finally came that he collared the Holy Spirit and threw him out the window. Sartre said he did not want a God who was constantly staring at him and watching his every move and judging his every action. But you see, the fact that you're uncomfortable under the holy gaze of God has nothing to do with whether God exists or not. Obviously, the existence of a holy God is going to be inconvenient to those who are living contrary to his moral claims. And by the way, the Bible says that's all of us. All of us are living contrary to the moral demands of God, and therefore all of us have something of an axe to grind with God. We don't want to be scrutinized. Those who are living in sexual immorality, in particular, have found it very popular to run to the philosophers to get some kind of ammunition, to say there is no God, as though they're building a roof over their head and they don't have to let the revelation of God in, and then they can live their lives the way they want to. One thinks of Dostoevsky, who wrote in The Brothers Karamazov, if God does not exist, everything is permissible. But you see, the tender-minded atheist who doesn't want God to exist so that everything will be permissible, so that he or she can engage in their sexual laxity, is not going to be satisfied by the type of considerations we bring tonight. Friedrich Nietzsche personally needed atheism to satisfy himself as a person. That's why he wrote, and I'm quoting him, "If there were gods, how could I bear not to be a god? Consequently, there are no gods." And so you see, atheists and theists both have this tendency toward a tender-minded approach to the subject. For our purposes tonight, we're going to be concerned with the question of the truth of God's existence. Not the psychology and the sociological factors of theism and atheism. We're not going to be looking at subjective feelings. We're not going to be looking at personal desires. But rather, we're going to give attention to the more objective consideration of things like intellectual evidence, logic, and proof. And that leads me then to say something about proof. You need to be aware of the fact that an argument does not need to be accepted by everyone in order for the argument to be conclusive. I'm going to set before you an argument tonight. It may be a good argument, it may be a bad argument, but whether it's good or bad will have nothing to do with the fact that some people don't accept it. For you see, there's a complete difference between proving something and persuading an individual. Sometimes people are persuaded of things and they don't have good proof at all for what they're persuaded of. Other times you may have a very good proof of something and a person refuses to be persuaded. So persuasion and proof are completely different matters. And I did not come tonight with the intention of being able to persuade just anybody that God exists. There are a lot of factors in persuasion that I don't control and that I couldn't do a whole lot about, even those few that I do control. What I can set before you, however, is a proof that is worthy of your consideration. Remember that as we talk about the existence of God, we want to distinguish between what in philosophy we call metaphysics and epistemology. Metaphysics studies that which is real, that which exists, structure, origin, configuration of reality, the world, the universe, whatever it may be. Metaphysics talks about reality, being. Epistemology, on the other hand, studies the nature and limits of human knowledge. How we are able to know, by what standard we know, what we're talking about when we discuss knowledge or belief, and so forth. There is a difference then between something existing and someone knowing that it exists. Something can exist without the person or a person knowing it. Obviously, you can have cancer in your body without knowing that you have cancer in your body. There's a difference between the objective reality of the cancer and your epistemological awareness of it. Moreover, something can exist without a person being able to prove it. There are plenty of people in hospitals that have cancer that do not have the medical technology or even the high school education by which they could prove that they have cancer. They just have to accept it on the say-so of the doctor and authority. And there, it's possible for things to exist even though a person offers reasons against it. There are people that have cancer who argue, no, I don't have cancer. And sometimes can deduce what appear to be fairly good reasons for saying that they don't have cancer. So let's just remember that as we go on tonight. There's a difference between the existence of God and a person knowing that God exists, being able to prove that God exists. There's a difference between God existing and someone offering reasons against his existence. And this leads me then finally, in terms of the parameters of tonight's lecture, to make one final introductory remark about faith and reason. I would contend tonight that it is mistaken and it is misleading to think that faith takes over where reason leaves off. It's mistaken and misleading to portray, for instance, Christianity, that version of theism that I endorse individually, to portray Christianity as having a notion of faith that says faith is whatever. Faith is that which bolsters our beliefs when reason no longer can take care of us. Faith is not something other than reason. Often enough, we have people, fideists we call them, who would argue that faith is somehow without reason or above reason. I love that metaphor, above reason. Many times, faith is presented as contrary to reason, as though somehow it's really admirable to hold on to your faith against all the evidence, against reason. Now, I don't want you to think that as a Christian theist tonight that I'm talking about fideism, faith independent of reason. But then on the other hand, you need to realize that reason can be affirmed. That is to say, man's intellectual tool, man's intellectual capability can be affirmed without endorsing rationalism. One can be very well rational without being committed to rationalism, the idea that man's mind is the highest authority, that man's thinking is somehow self-sufficient and autonomous. And so not only am I against fideism as I present my proof for God's existence tonight, I'm also against the notion of rational autonomy. I'm against it even when it's presented in the guise of, say, Thomistic reasoning in favor of God's existence. The idea of the unaided human reason being able to prove something. All reasoning rests upon some kind of faith. All reasoning has presuppositions. All reasoning rests upon an ultimate authority. That isn't to say we can't argue about those ultimate authorities, but you need to realize that presuppositional nature of reasoning. Reasoning is not neutral. It is not apart from considerations of worldview and ultimate commitments about reality and knowledge and ethics. Okay, so now the parameters, the cautions have been given. Let's get around to what we came here for. I want to suggest to you that the existence of God is true, and that we can prove that God exists. What do you mean by proof when you say that, Dr. Bonson? Well, a little bit about proof theory might be helpful, and I know that I'm talking to an audience that isn't full of philosophy majors necessarily, so I'll try to keep this rather simple. But when we talk about proof, it seems to me we have four basic, in the simplest sense, four basic approaches to proof. During the days of the heyday of epistemology in Western philosophy, two schools of thought, known as continental rationalism and British empiricism, stood over against each other and took different approaches to how man knows what he knows and what the standard of his knowing would be. According to the rationalist approach to justifying claims of knowledge, what we have are clear and distinct ideas that become the benchmark of truth for us. When an idea has that character of being clear and distinct, then we know that it has been proven. That justifies it rationally. The problem is that the rationalist criterion of truth fell into subjectivism so easily. The idea that I have some kind of inner experience or perception that makes a truth worthwhile. Moreover, the rationalists, to their embarrassment, could not agree with each other about the nature of reality. Here you have Descartes, who is a rationalist and begins with these clear and distinct ideas, and he says that reality is dualistic, mind and body. And then Spinoza, who is another rationalist, who can be so very sure of his starting points and his geometric reasoning and conclusions, and he comes to a more pantheistic, monistic conclusion about reality. And then you have Leibniz, who again is one of these rationalists who can be so very sure about his reasoning and prove all these things, and yet he comes to a view of reality that says that it's atomistic, that it's just permeated with all these little bundles of energy called monads. And so what is it for you rationalists who have these clear and distinct ideas? Is reality dualistic, monistic, or atomistic? That's a real embarrassment. Rationalism is simply unreliable as our standard of proof. And then the empiricist would argue that we prove things because we are able to tie every one of the premises in our argument to something that comes from our own experience or observation in the world. The British empiricists like Locke and Berkeley and Hume, however, easily ran into problems with what we call cognitive psychology, not being able to figure out how the human mind works using sensation to produce propositions and to gain information that is understandable. Empiricism became self-defeating. If everything that we know is based upon some kind of observation, the use of my senses, then the proposition that everything I know is based on observation is itself not something I can know. Because I can't use observation, I can't use my senses to prove that basic proposition. And thus empiricism ended up, especially in the case of David Hume, in skepticism. And so there you have rationalism ending up in an unreliable kind of arbitrary position, and empiricism ending up in a skeptical position. And what are we going to do? Where are we going to go from here? The end of the 1800s, and as we came into the 20th century, a popular option, and one that is still with us today in epistemology, is to take a more pragmatic approach to truth. The pragmatist says that it isn't important that we are able to gain certainty about the things we believe. Certainty can be dispensed with. The only thing that really counts is the ability to adapt to our environment and solve our problems. And so if you hold a belief which proves to be useful in adaptation, successful in gaining an answer to the problems that are confronting you in your existence, then of course you have proof. You have pragmatic proof. It's usable, it's proven. It's got enough cash value, that's all we really care about. Pragmatism, however, upon analysis, turns out to be very short-sighted, because the pragmatist doesn't take into account all of the consequences of a particular proposition. The pragmatist, in fact, doesn't even know which ends we should be seeking when we say something is proven when it helps us to solve our problems. Well, which problems should we be solving? What are the real problems? What is the end that we should have in mind when we go about solving our problems? And so pragmatism, I really think, turns out to be a refusal to face the tough questions in philosophy, and simply to settle for, well, we're getting by all right. But of course, whether we're getting by with the right sorts of things, whether we really do have truth in traditional sense or not, is never answered. That leaves us then with what I think is the fourth approach to proof, and the one that I'm going to be using tonight. In some situations, not everything we talk about, when we try to talk about the best way to milk cows or to make peach pie or to send rockets to the moon, we may not use this kind of proof, but there are some places in the intellectual spectrum where this kind of proof is required. It's what's called transcendental proof. Transcendental proof comes in when you try to show something is true from the impossibility of the contrary. That is to say, I know that this proposition is true because otherwise we'd be led to an absurdity or to an impossible situation. Specifically, transcendental proof, as we see it in Immanuel Kant, was an attempt to provide the preconditions of intelligibility for human experience. We're not talking about the price of eggs at the store when we argue transcendentally. We're not even talking about whether the music of Bach is better than the Beatles. We're not into any of those kind of inter-school debates. The transcendental type of argument is used when you talk about the most basic assumptions or presuppositions that are used in a person's thinking. Specifically, philosophers, many philosophers would say, I would say that the only way to defeat what is called radical doubt, the person says, okay, I can doubt everything. I can doubt this, I can doubt that I'm really seeing you, I can doubt that I'm really, you know, conscious right now, this may be a dream, I can doubt the laws of science, I can doubt so many things that seem like common sense. I can even doubt that this is my hand through my face. That kind of radical doubt can only be answered, I believe, ultimately in a transcendental way, by arguing about the preconditions of intelligibility, arguing about what is assumed even when you doubt something, so that that can no longer be doubted, because in doubting it, you affirm it. Obviously, not all claims to transcendental certainty work. That is, not all claims that we're talking about the preconditions of intelligibility are going to work. I don't think the Kant's work. In the case of Immanuel Kant, he felt he was saving science by telling us that the human mind has a certain, if you will, structure ahead of time by which it formulates the sensations that come to us and makes them understandable. We are accustomed to thinking in terms of cause and effect. But that's not because there is cause and effect out in the world, but simply our mind requires us to think this way. So any information that comes to us is now going to be programmed in a cause-effect way. Kant thought that he was saving science against the skepticism of David Hume when he said that. In fact, he only psychologized science and did not save its objectivity at all. So the type of proof that I'll be bringing to you tonight is in the order of a transcendental proof for God's existence. Not a proof that is along the lines of rationalism or empiricism or pragmatism, but rather a proof that is transcendental. Now, having said that, I have to admit, it might be tempting to offer a more empirical or rational proof for God's existence because, you know, natural science, especially in our day, is making it harder and harder to avoid God, the Creator. It's turning out more and more that atheists are required to exercise what has to be considered monumental faith in the most highly improbable scenarios. Let me just give you a few illustrations quickly. This is just a tidbit. In 1983, Paul Davies published a book entitled God and the New Physics. And he points out there that there are noteworthy numerical constants found throughout nature. For instance, fundamental regularities like the value of the weak and strong forces in the nucleus of an atom. Amazing constants that are found there in nature. He argues that if the expansion rate of the Big Bang had varied either way, listen to this, 1/1,000,000,000, if the expansion rate had been different one way or the other, 1/1,000,000,000, and if the balance of matter to antimatter had not been delicately harmonized, there could be no universe which would have arisen, and certainly no universe that would have been capable of sustaining life as we now know it. Cambridge astronomer Fred Hoyle calculated the likelihood of life originating through random chance. And his conclusion was that the likelihood was 1/10^40. You all know because you're at a good, strong school. That means 10 with 40 zeros following. One chance in that huge number. Charles Thaxton and Walter Bradley and Roger Olson wrote a book in 1984 entitled The Mystery of Life's Origin, in which they point out that DNA molecules contain not merely redundant order, but contain what we call information, which is especially important when you consider computer technology, when you consider the search for intelligent life in outer space, and any number of other areas. DNA contains information, not simply redundant order, which would seem to point to an intelligence behind the formation of DNA. In 1983, Stanley Jockey wrote Angels, Apes, and Men. He found it fascinating that the brain and the senses of the human organism are capable of consciousness, capable of self-consciousness, capable of a reliable awareness and understanding of the world that is external to them. How does that happen by chance? That the organism that we call a human being has a brain and has senses that is self-conscious and has a reliable cognitive apparatus. After all, why would we trust our intellectual and sensory faculties to provide us with accurate information about what lies outside of the human organism if those faculties are the result of random, arbitrary chance forces? Given the second law of thermodynamics, in a closed system, the amount of energy is always going to decrease, and thus increase the disorganization and randomness of that system until an equilibrium is achieved. Given this second law of thermodynamics, the universe could not be eternal for the very simple reason that we would already have achieved the state of equilibrium if we had an infinite amount of time passed that things were running down. We had already arrived at the cold and disorganized lack of energy that the universe, we are told, is working toward right now. And thus the universe would appear to have had to have a startup at some point. We look at the Big Bang Theory, which traces back to Edwin Hubble's discovery of the redshift phenomenon in 1929. Big Bang Theory tells us that space is expanding outward, all bodies are growing apart, from an initial one-time and unrepeatable explosion. Naturally enough, you ask, explosion? Explosion of what? And the answer is that all energy, apparently, was at one time compacted into a mathematical point without dimensions. As Hoyle put it, the universe was shrunk down to nothing at that point. The philosopher Anthony Kenney says the matter of the universe came from nothing and by nothing. And thus, we are seriously to believe, if we listen to some of the indications in modern physics and biology, modern natural science, we are seriously to believe that everything in the splendid universe and all the galaxies, that everything came from nothing. From the point of nothing, the compacting of all energy, the universe has come. Inexplicably, randomly, contrary to everything we experience in life now, and thus irrationally. I want to suggest that these evidences of the beginning of the universe are not proofs of God's existence. They are not refutations of atheism, but they are certainly embarrassments. They certainly make it very awkward for the atheist to say he's a rational man. He's rational until he gets back to the question of origins, and then he becomes very irrational, appealing to the random, inexplicable, and that which is contrary to everything else he knows in his experience. If people were to try to prove God's existence in that way, though I think these indications embarrass the atheist, they would not be on philosophical good ground. Perhaps the most popular argument for the existence of God that we've seen through the history of Western thought is called the cosmological argument, an argument that focuses upon the concept of causation as evidence for God's existence. And I believe the cosmological argument, as it's been traditionally formulated, is a misguided attempt to prove God from what is considered an allegedly neutral perspective that has no worldview presuppositions except those that are commonly agreed upon by theists and atheists both. Now, I want to suggest that that kind of argument is misguided. Let me explain why, and then finally I'll try to tell you in our remaining words how I think we can prove God's existence. The argument for God on the basis of causation argues from our experience of secondary causes, that is, our awareness that in this world there are causes that are themselves caused, so they are second causes. Or, if you will, it's an argument for what we might call very simply a chain of causes. One thing causes another, which itself becomes the cause of a third thing, and on down the chain. Now, if there is such a chain of secondary causes, causes which are themselves caused, then it would seem to imply, we are told, that there is a first cause of this entire natural order, a first cause of the causal chain as a whole. Now, sometimes people think that the cosmological argument begins with the premise every effect has a cause. Let's just take care of that right away. Every effect has a cause is not a premise for an argument because it's trivial. It's trivial because it's true by definition. Every effect, by definition, has a cause. That's why it's called an effect. So when you hear Christians sometimes argue that way, you might want to help them along by saying, you're not helping your case by beginning with a tautology of that sort. Because then the question becomes, is the universe an effect? Should it properly be called an effect or not? No, the argument that we call the cosmological argument begins with a premise like this. Every event has a cause, or, in some cases, every object has an origin. Every event has a cause, or, if you will, every object has an origin. Now, the cosmological argument starts with one of those as an empirical premise, a premise that is known from observation, our own experience, based on something that's familiar to us. We see events have causes behind them. We see that objects have an origin. They come from somewhere. The argument begins with that empirical premise and then picks up its impetus, I think, sometimes from a desire or a quest for complete explanation and then moves to the conclusion that God must be added to the chain of causes, or if you will, God must be added to the world. Let's review just for a minute. Cosmological argument says we can approach this in a neutral way without preconditions, without presuppositions, and we can agree with each other that every event has a cause or every object has an origin. We see that there's a chain of causation, so there must be a first cause for the entire chain. Which is to say, we understand the world and our observation of the world just fine. And if we think clearly and follow out our premises, then we will eventually add God to our knowledge of the world. This argument assumes that human experience and human reasoning are in themselves intelligible, perfectly all right as far as they go. No questions philosophically about our interpretation of human experience or our reasoning process. They are autonomous. They are self-sufficient. And so the theist asks the atheist to just take his thinking as it is, perfectly all right as far as it goes, and simply reason a bit further so that God becomes the conclusion that you add to your knowledge of the world. God gets added on to what is already known about the world. And I'd be the first to tell you, even though I am a theist, that when people reason in that way, philosophically, you would have to reject that kind of argument. It's a very bad line of argument. Though I do think the concept of causation will show us that God exists, it will not show us in this way. Let me give you six real quick reasons why the cosmological argument, as traditionally formulated, I think is not going to do the job. You see, if we begin with the premise that every object has an origin, then you can figure this out too. Then God, too, as an object, must have an origin. And so God doesn't turn out to be the first cause after all. And so I think children understand that when they ask their parents, well, God made everything, who made God, right? Secondly, if we begin with the premise that every event has a cause or every object has an origin, if we begin with that kind of premise that mentions every event or every object, we have to ask, do we know that premise to be true empirically? That is, do we know that premise to be true on the basis of our observation, on the basis of our experience of the world? Well, obviously we don't, do we? For the simple reason that nobody has observed everything. Nobody knows everything about the natural world, so no one's in a position empirically to say every event has a cause. Thirdly, it is often said by people who argue on the basis of the cosmological argument that an infinite regress of entities, or an infinite regress of events, back, must be ruled out. Because if you have an infinite regress of events back through history, then history would never get started. There would never be a start point for these things we consider added by successive addition, event after event after event after event. Therefore, you can't have an infinite regress of such events. I would reply to that that an infinite regress of entities shouldn't be ruled out by that kind of argument. An argument that says, well, then the universe could never have gotten started, because that then begs the question. That's exactly what we want to know. Did the universe ever have a start? Or is the universe in some sense eternal, even though we don't understand all the different forms of matter and events as they may go back so far? Fourthly, anybody who has studied quantified logic knows very well that the cosmological argument commits a conspicuous mistake in logic, a quantifying mistake, because the argument is there is a cause for each event. And then the conclusion is there is a cause for all events. And those are not the same at all in terms of quantification. To say that there is a cause for each event is to consider every event separately. This event has a cause, this event has a cause, that event has a cause, so forth and so on. But the conclusion is that there is a cause, a single cause, for all events collectively, if you will. That is not logical at all. Moreover, it's logically fallacious to argue from a property of the parts of something to the property of the whole. It's logically fallacious to argue that if every part of the universe has a cause, therefore the universe as a whole must have a cause. That would be similar to arguing that some huge display of Legos somewhere must weigh less than an ounce because every part in the display weighs less than an ounce. You can't argue from the properties of the part to the property of the whole. And then finally, and most, I think, notoriously, it can be said against the cosmological argument that even if all events in nature have a first cause, we have no basis to infer that that first cause is not a natural cause. That is to say, we have no basis for inferring a non-natural cause for nature as a whole. You see, the premises in the argument, in the cosmological argument, pertain to the temporal realm of human experience. But the conclusion of the cosmological argument pertains to the transcendent, supernatural cause that is outside of human experience, outside of time. And so, you see, the premises talk about one kind of thing, the conclusion talks about another. We have the right to ask whether the causal principle even has any meaning outside of temporal human experience. So here I spent all this time telling you how we shouldn't prove God's existence. The cosmological argument will not do it. It will not satisfy, I think, the demand for proof. So let me try my hand at what I call the transcendental proof for God's existence. An argument that God exists from the preconditions of intelligibility, from the impossibility of the contrary. The question that I'm going to ask here is, do we have a reason for believing the causal principle at all? Do we have a reason for believing what's called the inductive principle? Can the inductive principle, the causal principle, be justified as reason? And here, instead of ignoring worldview considerations and differences between different worldviews, I'm going to aim to make God not the reasonable conclusion of my argument, but rather compare worldviews and consider God the starting point for all reasoning and all argumentation. That is simply to say, we should set the theist and the anti-theist, the atheist worldviews, side by side and ask which one of them provides the preconditions for rationality, which one provides the preconditions for intelligible experience or science or ethics or man's dignity or life's meaning. So let's go back quickly here as we conclude tonight and just consider causality once again. Go back and reconsider an argument with respect to causality. The causal principle is one of those general principles by which inferences are drawn from particular data of sensation. If we didn't have those general principles, all we'd have are experiences, one-time, sui generis experiences that do not connect with one another, and in terms of which we cannot draw any further conclusions. I see red here now. I can't go any further than that. The causal principle is necessary to get beyond the individual data of experience to other conclusions. We talk about causality. We are saying that certain factors and events did not simply precede another event, but that certain factors and events caused that other event. That there was some kind of necessary and thus predictable connection between the first event and the second. When it is a necessary connection and a predictable connection, then we say A caused B. Now, all human reason, whether we think about our ordinary personal affairs or whether we think about sophisticated scientific work, all human reasoning assumes this causal principle, assumes this predictability. We can reason from past experience, the regular connections we see in the past. You stub your toe, it hurts. In the past, stub your toe in the future, it will hurt. You bake a peach pie this way in the past, that's what's going to happen when you do the same kind of, you know, procedures in the future. The laws of motion that we understand in the past are going to be applicable in the future. When we proceed on the conviction that there are these regular connections in our past experience that will hold for our future experience, we are operating on the causal principle or the inductive principle. We do that all the time. I just mentioned the conviction that the laws of motion are going to remain in operation tomorrow. We expect the sun to rise tomorrow. We're all assuming then the principle of causality or induction. The question is, do we have a reason for believing the inductive principle? Do we have a reason for believing? And I go back to the beginning of my lecture. I'm asking for an intellectual reason for that principle that is necessary for all reasoning whatsoever. It's used in day-to-day experience. It's used in sophisticated science. We couldn't even have language without the assumption of the inductive principle. Now, what reason do we have for believing it? In asking for a reason, I'm not asking for what causes us to use the inductive principle. It may very well be that we are some kind of stimulus response mechanism, and we've been habituated to just expect the future to be like the past. That's not a reason. That just tells me psychologically why I operate that way. And remember, it's not going to do any good to say, well, I would like the future to be like the past. I mean, what kind of universe would it be if I couldn't count on the uniformity of nature? That's not the question either. The question is, do we have a reason to believe that? And I'd like to refer you to Bertrand Russell's book, The Problems of Philosophy, which was first published in 1912. And the reason I'm referring to Russell is because he's a well-known atheist, was a well-known atheist. Bertrand Russell had no sympathy for Christianity. He argued often and wrote often against it. One of his best-known popular essays was Why I Am Not a Christian. And so I'm not asking you to consider somebody that somehow secretly, you know, wants to help the Christian cause. When Russell looked at the question of induction in The Problems of Philosophy, he had this to say about it. He asked, do any number of cases of a law being fulfilled in the past afford evidence that it will be fulfilled in the future? If not, it becomes plain that we have no ground whatever for expecting the sun to rise tomorrow, or for expecting the bread we shall eat at our next meal not to poison us, or for any of the other scarcely conscious expectations that control our daily lives. Later he says, the belief in the uniformity of nature is the belief that everything that has happened or will happen is an instance of a general law to which there are no exceptions. That is, we try to reason in terms of law-like behavior, or, as I put it earlier, in terms of predictabilities, in terms of causal connections. We reason that what has been the case in the past will be the case in the future. He says it's the business of science to find such uniformities, such as the laws of motion and the law of gravitation, to which, so far as our experience extends, there are no exceptions. In this search, science has been remarkably successful, and it may be conceded that such uniformities have held hitherto. This brings us back to the question. Have we any reason, assuming that they have always held in the past, to suppose that such laws will hold in the future? Russell goes on to consider the person who argues, well, it's always been that way in the past. In the past, it turned out to be a reliable expectation that the future will resemble the past. And Russell says, such an argument really begs the very question at issue. It may be true that in our past experience, when we expected future events to resemble past events, they always did. But the question has to do, will that which we experienced and observed in the past also hold in terms of the future for us right now? We're not talking about whether this principle held in the past. The argument has to do about it holding in the future. And at the end of his discussion, Russell has this to say, the inductive principle, however, is equally incapable of being proved by an appeal to experience. Experience might conceivably confirm the inductive principle as regards the cases that have been already examined. But as regards unexamined cases, it is the inductive principle alone that can justify any inference from what has been examined to what has not been examined. All arguments which, on the basis of experience, argue as to the future, assume the inductive principle. And here's the kicker. Hence, we can never use experience to prove the inductive principle without begging the question. Every argument from experience that says past experience, that future experience would be like past experience, every argument from experience already assumes the inductive principle rather than proving the inductive principle. Now, what does Russell do about that? Because you know that he attempted to be a rational man. He was a very intelligent man, but he certainly had no sympathy for theism. Thus, we must either accept the inductive principle on the ground of its intrinsic evidence, or forego all justification of our expectations about the future. You notice how he conspicuously leaves out a third option, or appeal to the one who controls all events, sovereign God, as theism or as Christianity presents it, as a basis for knowing that the future will be like the past. He does not even want to look at that as an option, which is the most reasonable one. Given the Christian worldview, there is a reason for using the inductive principle. There is a rationale, then, for all of our reason. In non-Christian worldviews, you don't have that rationale at all. Russell says, I guess we're just going to have to look at the intrinsic evidence for the inductive principle. I'm going to suggest this notion of intrinsic evidence is simply pseudo-profound speaking for saying there is no evidence, and we're just begging the question without wanting to be caught doing so. When someone suggests, well, I have a pragmatic justification for it, I'll be more successful in working out my problems and adapting to my environment if I assume the inductive principle. But don't you see how the pragmatic justification also begs the question? In the past, you may have been more successful assuming natural uniformity, but will you be more successful in the future? You could only know that you would be more successful in the future if you knew what? That the future will resemble the past. Now, what reason can be offered for believing that? I would suggest to you that it is most reasonable to believe in God, and it is entirely unreasonable not to believe in God, because, as we've seen in this one little demonstration, God's existence turns out to be a precondition for all reasoning, no matter what you're talking about. It isn't as though God is the end of our proof. God is the starting point of all thinking and all proof. And that makes him the highest certainty, the most well-known fact, the most provable truth of all. I want to make a clarification, and then I'm going to end and ask you to give me your questions. I am not claiming here that a profession of God's existence or someone admitting openly that God exists is necessary to that person engaging in reason. Atheists reason all the time. There's no doubt about that. Sometimes atheists reason more clearly than theists do, to our embarrassment. So I'm not saying that atheists do not reason. I'm rather saying that an atheistic worldview, an atheistic basic presupposition about human life and knowledge and reality and so forth, an atheistic worldview cannot provide a cogent reason, not just the cause, not just the desire, so cannot provide a cogent reason for what we necessarily assume in all of our reasoning. Atheism cannot make sense out of our reasoning. Cannot avoid, then, intellectual arbitrariness. It cannot, put it simply, provide the preconditions for the intelligibility of man's reason and experience. Atheists live by habitual conditioning and blind faith regarding the presuppositions of rationality. We read in the Bible, in Psalm 14, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Often, I'm afraid, people read that literature and they think that's name-calling, which is kind of like, you know, nyan-nyan-nyan-nyan, and then you can come up with things to call people who believe in God and so forth. The Bible's not doing that. Sometimes followers of the Bible do it, but the Bible's not doing it. The Bible is referring to a mindset which is truly foolish because it will not consider what are the preconditions of human life, whether it pertains to morality or human dignity or what we would call science, intellectual matters. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Yet how could he say anything? How could he reason at all without God? And thus Romans 1, Paul's treatise on the condition of those who are unbelievers, tells us that though God has made himself clearly known to all men, those who do not believe in God are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. And though they profess themselves to be wise, they actually become fools. You can take the most brilliant men in the world. I've studied them, some of them. I've read many of them. Truly intelligent people. And yet, when all is said and done, it goes back, they cannot make sense out of their most fundamental assumptions about reality. In fact, they cannot make sense out of those assumptions which are inescapable for all of us, such as the uniformity of nature, what we've called the causal or inductive principle. I suppose I could have come this evening and given my entire lecture a lot shorter space of time if I would have simply told you and then said maybe we ought to sit here for an hour and meditate on it. The proof of God's existence is that without Him, you can't prove anything at all. One more time. The proof of God's existence is that without Him, you cannot prove anything at all. Arguing from the precondition of intelligibility for man's rationality, that if we do not have God guaranteeing the causal principle, the inductive principle, which is necessary for all our reasoning, it turns out there is no final reason or rational foundation for what we are doing here at the university or out in daily life. Thank you very much.